You're listening to The Read Out, one development leader, their big idea, and how it can shape the future of Australian development assistance. Hosted by Lab CEO, Bridie Rice.
Australia is no stranger to providing law and justice assistance to countries in our region. Think policing support in Papua New Guinea, human trafficking support in the Mekong. Indeed, in a former life, I led government-to-government legal cooperation programs working on law reform in places like Sri Lanka and Cambodia. But while strengthening and working alongside the police, courts, and formal legal projects is the most obvious thing that comes to many policymakers' minds when we talk about law and justice support, there are other aspects of justice that are often overlooked. As research shows, many people in our region seek justice outside a court of law and spend more time with informal systems of justice than they do with the police, the laws, and the courts. So why is it that Australia continues to privilege policing and formal justice sector support in the way that we do? To discuss the findings of such research and what it means for Australia's development policy in the region, I am thrilled to have here with me Lisa Denny. Lisa is Deputy Director of La Trobe University's Centre for Human Security and Social Change, and she's also the lead author of an International Development Law Organisation report called Diverse Pathways to People-Centred Justice. Hi, Lisa. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Bridie. Lovely to be here.
Lisa, you've spent almost your whole career travelling around the world to study informal security and justice institutions. What triggered this interest and what was the moment that led you to write this report?
Yeah, so my career, I guess, started with an interest in post-conflict transitions. I was working in Sierra Leone in the lead up to the first self-administered election there after the Civil War. And there was all this money pouring into Sierra Leone at that time to reform the police, courts, to run a special court that was trying those deemed most responsible for atrocities in the war. And while all of that was happening, I was really struck by the fact that these formal or statutory justice institutions were at such a remove from the communities that they were meant to serve. So the community was actually relying on chiefs and their local courts, community-initiated policing, and even secret societies, these kinds of informal institutions, to deal with their disputes and grievances. So I've been fascinated by this conundrum of why we continue to be so focused on strengthening justice systems as we think they exist from a kind of top-down organogram perspective, when so few people actually use those systems and actually rely on all these other justice providers. So that was the case in Sierra Leone, and it's the case in Ethiopia to Myanmar to PNG. And as I've worked more and more with donors then, I've also been equally fascinated by the fact that even when their staff understand that reality and maybe even want to engage with it, they're often hamstrung in doing so because of their own political and bureaucratic constraints. So the report you mentioned, published by the Working Group on Customary and Informal Justice, has been part of this ongoing process of more and more policymakers, practitioners, researchers coming together to call for a step change, really, in the way that we do justice support. So justice support from donors overall has been declining in recent years. Between 2018 and 2021, donors cut their investments in justice by a third. So there's a general call to increase investments in justice. But rather than continuing to concentrate those investments on formal justice systems, the working report is really an effort to say that we also need to be doing something different to be relevant and to deliver for people. And then very practically, it sort of sets out what different can look like so that we can start to move in that direction.
So let's dig a little bit deeper into this report. So in the working report, you conclude that while there are some risks in what you call engaging with customary and informal justice mechanisms, ultimately these informal ways of seeking justice remain the most popular option and they need to be better recognised by donors. What would change if your findings were taken on board in this report?
Good question. So maybe first to describe what I mean by customary and informal justice, it's a very imperfect shorthand. So by that, I'm referring to the diverse actors that people turn to resolve their disputes, their grievances and crimes. Many of those actors are outside of what we think of as the formal legal system of the state. So they are chiefs, elders, community or religious leaders, paralegals, human rights defenders, and so on. And often they're actually these kinds of hybrids. So they might be recognized or endorsed by the state in some way. In other cases, they can exist entirely separately and even in competition with the state. So we see that, for instance, in Myanmar with the ethnic armed groups, which have their own justice systems. So people rely on this sort of mix of justice actors for lots of different reasons. Often they're considered more accessible, more affordable. They operate in local languages and don't use, you know, unfamiliar legalistic jargon. And they're seen to deliver more timely decisions. But also they're often more trusted and considered more legitimate by local communities than the police and the courts. So that might be because of conflict legacies or the failure of the state to deliver services. But it also points to different ideas of what justice entails that we see between these different justice providers. So there's not just a plurality of justice providers, but there's also different ideas of what justice actually is. And so you see differences in things like the balance between individual and community rights, or the extent to which justice is punitive or restorative. And this stuff is important because there's often actually fundamental contestation over what justice is between these different actors and by what we mean by it. And often I think that gets ignored in programming. So Australia and the international community have committed to justice for all by 2030 in the SDGs. Obviously, that's a pretty bold aim. There is simply no way we will come close to achieving that goal if we continue to focus the lion's share of investment on justice systems that most people don't use. So what we gain from engaging with these diverse justice providers is law and justice support that's actually more relevant and more impactful to people's lives. And I think it's important to note that Australian law and justice programs are actually already even doing some of this currently. So the program in Vanuatu works with the Malbatumari Council of Chiefs. In PNG, there's work with the village courts. In Indonesia, with the religious courts and paralegals. So, you know, we're not starting from scratch here. There is stuff to build on, but we need to move it from being, you know, a small part of what we do on justice work to being much more centrally relevant.
So let's go another round on what this all means for Australian law and justice support. In your report, you're urging practitioners tackling law and justice issues to go out there and you say meet people where they are by working on customary and informal justice rather than, as you say, remaining laser focused on formal justice projects. But Lisa, how practical is this as a recommendation for a donor like Australia? We don't have a law and justice unit in DFAT anymore. Customary and informal justice is not necessarily part of our federal police's strategic priorities. So notwithstanding some of the good examples you have already mentioned, what would be your reform agenda for Australia? How can we improve our approach to law and justice support in the region?
Yeah, so I think meeting people where they are at is about making our assistance more people-centred. So making people the locus of our assistance rather than institutions. So we do a lot of institutional strengthening in development and in police cooperation. And, you know, institutional strengthening is fine if it delivers better outcomes for people. But what I think we see is that a lot of support, and not just in the justice sector, ends up treating institutional strengthening as the end goal in itself. And that's based on this very big assumption that stronger institutions lead to better outcomes for people. And we just know that's not the case. So, you know, we can have a better trained, more capacitated police force that's better at oppressing the population. Or we could have a more efficient court system that, you know, gets through cases, reduces case backlogs, but contributes to prison overcrowding. Or we can have these nice, shiny, you know, online record systems that can't be used because of unreliable electricity and internet and whatnot. So there's lots of reasons why strengthening institutions doesn't necessarily mean better justice outcomes. Partly, I think we keep approaching law and justice assistance this way because it's what we know. You know, donor countries are renowned for exporting their own systems because that's how they see the world. And, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So there is also, I think, still this kind of underlying belief of, you know, if we build it, they will come. If only we could make the police, the court, prosecutions operate as we think they should, then those other justice providers will just, you know, simply wither away. But that's not borne out in practice. So, you know, in terms of your question, what do we do? I would say we don't start with this top-down view of the justice sector and focus our support on the institutions that appear there. Instead, we start by mapping out, you know, first, what are people's justice challenges? And second, where do people access safety and justice to deal with those issues and why? So that start gives us a better sense of the whole ecosystem from the perspective of justice seekers themselves. And what we start to see when we do that is that people follow whole range of different pathways that usually include a mix of justice providers. And these intersect in different ways, right? So we see some customary providers referring serious crimes to courts. We might see courts referring some matters to customary settings. And we see some people pursuing, you know, multiple routes at once. We get these kind of justice chains or pathways that are what people actually follow in practice, rather than the theory of how justice seeking is meant to look according to laws or policies. And then we can start to identify within those chains, where are there blockages that are preventing people from accessing or achieving justice? And how can we orient our support around addressing those? So we might even end up doing institutional strengthening as part of that, but it's then very intentional, focused on solving a particular justice problem that people experience. And maybe just to say, I mean, I think while these sort of diverse justice providers are unfamiliar to us, what a great space to bring to bear Australia's Indigenous foreign policy and look at what experience Indigenous Australian communities might have to bring to bear on how people navigate these sort of multiple legal orders.
Yeah, Lisa, it sounds as though you're making a strong call for some user-centred design to be incorporated in Australia's development programming approaches. Well, Lisa, you and I could talk for hours about this subject, but believe it or not, it is now time to wrap up. So if you're familiar with the readout, then you should know that it is time to tackle our standing lab hypothetical. So Lisa, I want you to imagine that you're boarding an elevator. And as you enter, you find the foreign minister to your left and the minister for international development to your right. Now, you've only got 1 minute before you reach your destination. So what is the one change they should make to Australia's approach on law and justice off the back of your research? Over to you.
Put people back into Australia's justice and rule of law support. The rule of law is fundamental to peace and prosperity in the region and deserves considerable investment. But the rule of law has to deliver for people, not just for institutions that are often not widely used. So most people resolve their problems and claim their rights outside of formal justice systems. We need to engage with the diverse ways in which people access justice. Yes, through the courts and police, but also through customary and religious avenues, through community-led initiatives. We already do that at small scale in some programs, so we need to learn from those experiences and build on them. If we don't, our law and justice support will only sort of dabble on the edges of the real ways in which people navigate justice. Our contribution will fall far short of its potential, and we will fail to meet SDG 16.3 on access to justice for all.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for taking this time to chat. It's been wonderful to have you.
Thanks so much, Bridie. It was great to join you.
Join me next time on The Readout, where each episode we sit down with one author, one big idea, and talk about how it can shape the future of Australia's development assistance. If you liked hearing from Lisa, you can find a link to her report in our show notes. And if you want extra previews, insights, and development analysis, then sign up to our email at devintelligencelab.com. Special thanks to the lab team behind the scenes, Ruby St. Ledger, Ruby Solwick, and Walter Kolnagy. Our music is by Viljami Meto. I'm Bridie Rice. This is The Readout. Talk soon.
We at The Lab acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is recorded, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we extend our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We're inspired by the storytelling tradition of the world's oldest living culture, and we pay homage to it when we share our stories or intelligence on this podcast.